Shalom, Baruchim Haba'im, welcome. Welcome to Awakening Torah, Musar, Mindfulness, a wonderful weekly public offering by the Institute for Holiness, Hamachon LeKedusha, Kehilat Musar, Mindfulness, where we engage in learning and a lifelong practice on the path towards holiness. From the two ancient traditions of the Dharma and Theravada Buddhism, learning from mindfulness and Musar in Judaism. I am Rabbi Chasya Uriah Steinbauer. I'm delighted to have you. So first we say happy Thanksgiving to all of our Americans who are so dedicated to the Institute for Holiness and who join us weekly. We hope that you are enjoying your gratitude and time with family and friends. And if you aren't with family and friends, may you take refuge with us tonight in this practice. Well, normally we meet Motzei Shabbat or on Sunday after the Torah portion that we're going to cover together. But as you all know, we are in the middle of quite difficult times here in Israel. And that has weighed on me very, very much so. And it's affecting my health and well-being. And so not always do I have the energy and health and time to present exactly right afterwards. So thank you for your patience. Today is, well, here in Israel, it's already Friday, Yom Shishi. But over in North America and Canada, where we have many people join us, it is Thursday, November 23rd. Today in Israel, it's Friday, November 24th, 1:14 in the morning. We are going to cover the Torah portion that took place on November 18th, 2003, which is Toldot. Okay, Toldot is our sixth sitting of this year from the sixth Parsha in Bereshit. And the date, the Hebrew date was the Hey of Kislev, 5th of Kislev, in the Hebrew year Tafshin Pei Dalet, 5784. So if you're new to us, welcome. Jump in with both feet. We will cover the weekly Torah portion from the perspective of Musar mindfulness for us to learn the most from our ancestors and from God. Before we begin, we always share our kavanot, our intentions for this practice, which has been the same kavanah for the past 2-3 years. I'm going to add another element here from one of our donors, actually, in honor of Sarah. Her Hebrew name is Sarah. Bat Avraham Vesara, and she is sick in the hospital. And so we have a couple of our supporters who are really sponsored this session to send health and healing to her and health and healing to all those who are in pain or suffering, and in particular, the hostages, the captives in Gaza, and their families and friends and all of Am Yisrael who are waiting in anticipation and praying for that they be brought home as soon as possible. Okay, so here is our, if you have vision and you're watching on video, before you are three kavanot, three intentions. Otherwise, you'll hear me on audio saying what these are. So we always say this time together during awakening, Torah, Musar, mindfulness, that we do this as an act of radical self-care. And we're doing this to strengthen our own soul so we can be benefit to others in the future. We're also doing this as an act for others to strengthen our relationship to others so we can be a better conduit of God's good to others when they need us. And we're also doing this to strengthen our relationship with God, with Hashem, the divine, so that we can be a better conduit of God's good. So all these kavanot, these intentions, really come both, I'm going to stop sharing screen if you are watching by video. really come from the concept of the altar of Kelm. If you don't know any of anything about the three schools of Mussar, one of them was Kelm, the Kelm school, and the altar, meaning the elder, the head of the Kelm school, he really believed in and pushed forward this concept of bearing the burden with the other, and that being our great purpose in life. And Levinas also touches on this, of course, from a different angle. So then you have later on Rabbi Shimon Shkop and his introduction to Sha'arei Yosher, that my wonderful friend and colleague Rabbi Micha Berger has written about in his book called Widen Your Tent. Highly recommend it. It's basically the philosophy of why we practice and do Musar. So in here is what I would say is our mission statement as Jews and as people who follow either the Noahal laws or are really informed by and want to be by Jewish teachings. Okay, so he goes on to say, Rabbi Shimon Shkop, blessed be the creator, right? Yitbarach HaBorei. And exalted shall be the maker who created us in God's image, and in the likeness of his structure, and planted eternal life within us. Okay, here comes the part that you want to pay attention to. This is part of our covenant, our intentions for today. So that our greatest desire should be to benefit others. Lehitiv im zolteinu. Okay. To individuals and to the masses now and in the future, and in imitation of the creator. So you have to know that in Judaism, there's this real concept of following after the footsteps of Hashem, imitating the what we interpret to be good deeds, wholesome, wise, appropriate action that we want to emulate. So when God clothes the naked, for instance, clothing Adam and Chava, we are to clothe the naked. When Hashem buries Moshe Rabbeinu, we are to bury the dead. Things like that. So in here, he's saying this really deep thing, which comes from this idea of bearing the burden with the other, is that our greatest desire should be to benefit others. So may we merit this in our ongoing meeting together today and every time we practice and take refuge together. May we have full health and healing, a refuah shlema to Sarah, full health and healing and speedy recovery. As you all know, this has been dedicated this year to addressing our grief and loss to the genocide of October 7th in Israel, done by the Gazans, by Palestinian terrorists, and not only terrorists, Palestinian civilians who participated. We are obviously on this path, some of us towards healing, some of us towards recovery, some of us just coping, and really just seeing one another. Being able to be present for one another and using these teachings to really support one another through this. So that is our theme, and that's what we'll be bringing here together in order to practice. We'll cover the Torah portion as usual, and then we will engage in our mindfulness meditation practice so that we can apply some practice. Okay. So what happens in Toldot? Let's do our regular summary of what happens in this Torah portion, because we can't touch everything, of course, right? Lack of time. So Yitzhak, our second patriarch after Avraham, his son, okay, known as Isaac in English, Yitzhak prays for Rivka, his wife, who's known as Rebecca in English, to have children. It's been 20 years. 20 years she hasn't gotten pregnant. So he prays for her. This should already start ringing a bell to you because this is like, this is him being really assertive, beautiful, really caring for her. Talk about benefiting the other and doing something so different, radically different from his father, Avraham, right? who did not pray for Sarah, as far as we know. It wasn't recorded in the Torah, right? If anything, Sarah it might have suffered in some ways alone with this. I mean, you could tell that Abraham suffered by and constantly was questioning, when am I going to have a son? But you don't see this being shared in the couple and really praying together or on behalf of one another. And Sarah seems to have suffered alone to the point where she feels pressure to provide some other means, a surrogate. Obviously, her slave, her servant, Hagar, to be the woman that can provide the womb that will carry the child that she feels that Avraham needs and they need in their marriage. So this is very different. Yitzhak prays for Rivka to have children, and she becomes pregnant with twins. The twins struggle inside of her, and she goes and seeks out God. She doesn't go to her husband and talk to him about it. She goes to seek out God of why she's having this pain and fear and struggle inside of her. And God tells her this is because there are two nations within her, right? Which already begins, we can have a lot of questioning around this. Why can't two nations be in the womb and not fight? We'll address some of this. The firstborn is reddish and covered with hair. His name is Esav. And the second, who is born, is holding on to Esav's heel. Okay. And he's called Yaakov, because the root of Yaakov comes from Ekev to mean heel, right? Holding on to that heel. Interesting to be named after the act of what you're holding on to of another human being. Names have implications, right? And how they end up affecting us. So his is always going to be so much bound up in, always holding that heel of Esav, right? So we'll look into this. Yitzhak loves Esav. So the father loves his firstborn. Rivka loves the secondborn. The mother loves Yaakov. That should already be like ding, 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 ding. Problem. For the Torah to tell us that parents love, individual parents love different children differently, already is going to be a sign that there's going to be a problem here. Okay. Years later, Yaakov buys the birthright. It's questionable, that language, right? Special privilege, the birthright is special privileges that the firstborn has to serve the family and the father, basically replacing the father after death as the patriarch. Also receiving a double portion of the father's wealth, if there's any, after he passes away. And so Yaakov, in order to give Esav lentil stew when he comes back from hunting on behalf of the father, he's starving. He hasn't eaten in days. And he negotiates. He says, sell me, give me your birthright, and I will give you this stew. Okay, Yitzhak, the father, goes blind. At least that's how we interpret it. Okay. And he tells Esav that he's going to give him a bracha, a blessing. Rivka, the mother, hears this, but she wants Yaakov to receive the blessing. She wants her beloved, her child that she loves, to receive it. She tells Yaakov to wear Esav's clothing. So she tells her son to put on the clothing of his elder brother. Esav puts on goat skin on his arms so that he'll feel like Esav, who is a hairy person. Yaakov then goes to get the bracha from his father Yitzhak, who you have to remember is elderly, is dying, and is blind. Okay. Yitzhak notices that his son, Yaakov, sounds like Yaakov, but his hands feel like Esav because they're hairy, right? And so Yitzhak gives him the blessing, gives him the bracha. When Esav finds out what happened, so he returns after hunting and says, "Abba, father, give me the blessing." And the father says, "What? What happened? Someone came and deceived me." I wonder who that could be. And he's very upset, and Esav is so upset, he's sobbing and in so much pain that it then turns into vengeance and revenge. very upset, and he's planning on killing his younger brother, Yaakov. And the mother, Rivka, hears this, what Esav has said, and she's deeply, she's fearful. So she goes and tells Yitzhak, we got to send Yaakov away in order to get a wife. She doesn't tell him we have to send him away because he's going to be killed by his older brother. She deceives also and makes up this story. Okay. So there's a lot going on here. I'm going to give you a little bit more summary, and then we're going to move in, which is this whole Torah portion, Toldot, really is the second series in the whole patriarchal narratives, right, of who we have as patriarchs. We have Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. And so this is a section on Yitzhak, okay? And everything about him is exceedingly sparse, essentially. And much what that is preserved, like his birth, his circumcision, the akedah, meaning the binding of him, where he was going to be offered as a slaughtered as an offering to Hashem, because Hashem, God, commanded that of Abraham. And then his marriage, all these data on him, essentially data points, is really integrated and into the biography of Avraham, his father. It's really about Avraham, all these touch points, right? They are about his experience of Yitzhak, his experience of Yitzhak's birth, his experience of Yitzhak's circumcision, his experience of the Akedah, his experience of sending off his servant to get a wife for Yitzhak. All right. And basically, there's not much that's really his own narrative, and nothing is actually recorded in the first 20 years of his marriage. So the only things that we have are isolated events where he has to deal with some of the natives of the land and sharing the space and the wells or not. And everything is eclipsed essentially by this towering figure of the first patriarch, his father, Avraham. He's really overshadowed by him. And I want to just begin to say that this is indicative of the trauma that occurred when his father took him to sacrifice him, to slaughter him. It's very indicative that they leave and never speak again after that episode. There is a silence there. He doesn't, Yitzhak doesn't get to connect with his mother either. So there's another form of, we don't have to necessarily label it as trauma, but there's definitely grief and loss associated with his mother that just is compounded on top of what we can label it as most likely a traumatic event. It's open to interpretation, but there's so much evidence there that this child, as we said, is so overshadowed by a father that, for all intents and purposes, we could say it had too little humility when it came to the relationship with his son. What do we mean by that? It means he took up too much space and maybe even place in the Musar practice, where it's almost as if the child doesn't know who he is yet and hasn't fully developed and formed. And all the responses of Yitzhak, there's some key elements here. So Yitzhak's name is actually bestowed by God, by Hashem, and it's not changed. Like everyone else who gets a name change, like Avram becomes Avraham, and Yaakov ends up becoming Yisrael. There is no name change for Yitzhak. And his pastoral wanderings, right, are restricted. There's a lot of constriction, are restricted to a narrow range. And they're largely centered around Beersheba, right? And unlike his father, unlike Avraham, he does not live in Hebron and Kiryat Arba. And he only settles there in his old age. And he alone remains monogamous. does not marry more than one woman, does not try to reproduce with another woman in order to have an heir. His world went like this after the Akedah. We have no idea what he would be had the Akedah not happened. But this is what we witness essentially, okay? He's also the only patriarch to engage in agriculture. And I touched on this last week because there's a tikkun there. Like after Cain murders his brother Hevel, the first recorded murder in the Torah, he is forced to wander and he's lost his privilege to till the land and be someone who is of the land and works with the soil, right? And so suddenly we have this patriarch, Yaakov, where this is his primary endeavor, right? He's the one to engage in agriculture. He's also the only one to never leave Israel, to never leave the promised land. Abraham leaves during the famine, goes down to Egypt. Yaakov leaves, obviously, to go to Padan Aram to escape, to flee. He's kind of a refugee, to be honest with you. We'll touch upon that another time. Refugee by his own creation, unfortunately. He's the only one to remain in the land, okay? And there really is, you know, this unique divine name that's given to him in chapter 31, 42 of Pachad Yitzhak. We don't fully understand that. There must be some history and other stories around it, right? But to understand Pachad is fear, right? And it's not Yira, it's not fear and awe, like that we are to practice and cultivate towards God. This is pacha, this is fear, right? This is fear-based. And think about Yitzhak in that moment with the knife coming to slaughter him. Fear, right? Getting up from that and a ram replacing you and watching your father who was just about to slaughter you, slaughter this ram. Fear. And then leaving separate from your father. Fear. Okay, this is very hard. This is very someone who is dealing with grief and loss gets down, finds out his mother's not alive. Fear. How is he? Think about this. He's like totally uprooted. How is he going to survive, right? So let's delve into this, okay? How he manages this in his life, because I think we really can learn by looking at our ancestors of how each deals with grief and loss and sometimes trauma for us to be able to pivot and practice in response to the genocide of October 7th. So the first thing I want to pay attention to is that he, even though he's very constricted and full of fear, he's someone that decides, first of all, he has a very personal relationship with God in the sense that he decides to use what skill he has to be able to pivot and turn towards God and pray to God for a child. Even his wife has obviously a close relationship with God that she turns to God to talk about what's happening with her inside of her with the twins. So we do see him turning in a new way. It's a different response to grief, suffering, and loss that he uses prayer. Okay. We did not witness this before with Abraham or even Sarah. We definitely saw dialogue, we saw arguing, we saw engagement, we saw definite submission. Zerizut, energy, alacrity to fulfill God's commandment. And there's definitely a different way of service towards God and fulfilling what Abraham felt he had to and needed to. Yitzhak is much more reserved and turned towards prayer. And this is something that I think all of us can engage in and consider how If we are caught in our grief and loss in any of the four common responses, which are freeze, meaning I can't deal with this grief and loss or this trauma, and I freeze, right? I can't even, either emotionally, I freeze or even physically. The second is flight, meaning I might, in my mind and in my heart and soul, go away to the corner of the room, or I might physically actually flee. Right? I had some friends, for instance, who on October 8th were gone out of Israel. Flight. Couldn't deal. Great privilege, right? And blessing to be able to do that. And that was their response. Other people froze, right? Can't move at all. And then there's the fight, the third one, fight. The people who fight back immediately in response to trauma or grief and loss. Okay. And then the last one that's just been added recently in the world of trauma and grief and loss is called fawn, fawning. So when someone fawns, they're trying to placate, they're trying to please the oppressor or the person that's causing the grief or loss or the person that is causing the trauma to try to get them to not hurt them more or hurt the situation around them. We witnessed someone like this actually among one of the elderly women who came back as a hostage from Israel. There was a bit of fawning going on there. And so what you witness obviously to Avraham when he was dealing with his own grief and loss and real challenges, right? Where he feared that he was going to be murdered and that his wife was going to be kidnapped and all that difficulty and negotiation, right? When his nephew, cousin, he's called both things, Lot, is kidnapped and he heads off to war to save him. We see him fight. We see him, I don't know if I want to call it a flight or even a, there's a mixture of slight flight and fawning, right? Going on when he tries to negotiate with Avimelech or even Paro, the Pharaoh in Egypt. So we saw that, but Yitzhak here, there's definitely flight in the sense that we don't hear him communicate with his brother, his father anymore. And what comes up, to be honest with you, is Yitzhak runs into his own issues with some of the natives in the land who are threatened by his growing wealth, and they don't want him around, and they don't want him using the wells that he dug. And he avoids conflict at all costs, right? He's not his father at all. There's a form of flight that goes on from that kind of from that kind of conflict of not really just wanting to deal at all, which ends up isolating him. You know, it's the first recorded where are my notes here? It's the first recorded exile, the first expulsion of a Jew in the Torah is Yitzhak, where he is essentially not welcomed by his neighbors when he's dealing with his wells, and he submits. He goes into flight to the expulsion order without protest at all. And we could judge that or not, but we really just want to observe right now, right? We want to be fully awake, clearly seen, and observe his behavior and what's going on. All right, for some of us, that is how we will have to operate right now during this grief and loss or and trauma of the ongoing war, where we're waiting for over, 240 hostages. May they be returned speedily. There's a form of flight in the sense of just not going to engage in conflict, where we have witnessed other people move into fight mode. If you were able to witness, for instance, the dialogue between some Israeli lawmakers with some of the family members of the hostages, where they're screaming at them, right? In a like a verbal fight, when there's no need to treat anyone that way, especially family members who are surviving a trauma of a genocide and a kidnapping of their family members. It's shocking, right? It's that behavior is shocking. So we're witnessing the whole realm of this, okay? So what more do I want to say to you? I want you also notice Rivka's behavior, okay? Rivka, his wife, when she finds out, she's having these twins struggling in her womb. It's very painful. She even turns to the other women. She doesn't turn to her husband. She turns to the other women and she's like, "What's going on?" Right? And then she goes to God when she doesn't get an answer that satisfies her. And I really think we obviously don't know what was going on with Rivka, why she turned to God, what she was looking for exactly. Usually, when we think that we're turning to God for comfort, or to almost like a rescue, for help, for possibility. And what does God give her? God gives her a national narrative. God gives her that she has two nations in her womb, and this is why she's having this struggle. And maybe this helped her. Maybe gaining more information and gaining a narrative, a story around the unpleasantness, around the difficult stimuli that she's experiencing, right? The fear also. Maybe having that narrative really assisted her, or maybe not. I mean, we just don't know. But we all should pay attention in our own practice. What is the narrative that we're telling ourselves? What is the storytelling? What is the movie playing, right? And sometimes we need that, right? Sometimes we need that to survive the trauma and the grief and loss. And then other times we need to wake up and see, are we clearly seeing? Are we having the When I talked about this last week, are we having the long view? Are we able to incorporate compassion for others over time? These are the things that we eventually want to be concerned with, okay? So the last thing I will say is Yitzhak's form of kind of flight in order to deal with all this. This is how he even treats his own son. So later in the narrative of Toldot, his son, Yaakov, comes to him, deceiving him, essentially lying about who he is, invoking God's name in that lie, going as far as even to be dressed by his mother in clothing in an animal skin that will deceive the father, who is blind, dying, and old. And so when Yitzhak learns that he's been deceived by his son, you can definitely see there's judgment there and anger, but there's also flight. He doesn't address his son. He doesn't address the conflict. He doesn't address the deception. He doesn't confront him. There's no dialogue. There's no conversation. It's as if Yitzhak is repeating what happened with him and Avraham, now with Yaakov. There's going to be no discussion between father and son about what took place. Okay. And if anything, maybe Yitzhak experienced what Yaakov did as a, I mean, not Yaakov, his Abba, Avraham, as a big deception also, right? Or maybe even God. Like, I was supposed to be sacrificed, I wasn't. It's almost like survivor guilt, right? Especially if you're a child and you think this is what you were supposed to do, what you were your service. Even if he didn't interpret it that way, it's a big deception. Like, that he first his father won't even tell him that he's taking him to do this. When he says, where's the they're heading up to the mountain, he says, "Abba, father, where's the animal to be slaughtered?" And he said, "God will provide," right? Talk about, I mean, deception, right? And so this is Yitzhak. This is what he's learned. This is what he's seen from his own father, who also hid and possibly lied, but definitely hid from Sarah that he was taking their only son to sacrifice him. She ends up dying afterwards. We don't know if it's in reaction or response to it. We assume that in Midrashim, in our tradition. So this is Yitzhak's MO. He has learned, meaning modus operandi, how he behaves, how he's learned to function and operate in response to grief, trauma, and loss. Okay, so he goes into flight. So this is what he's done with Yaakov, gone into flight. He doesn't address what the deception is. He doesn't address him. That's it. Okay. So talk about deception. We're now going to start seeing a pattern, unfortunately, in the Torah. And we all need to keep this in mind, because who do we spend the majority of our lives with? Which is family, right? And nobody likes to talk about this, but who can cause the most harm and suffering often in our lives? Our family. Not all the time, obviously, right? Like the genocide of October 7th was not done by family. But we know statistically that incest, abuse, rape, kidnapping are predominantly done by family members, okay? The most extreme acts. So here in the Torah, we're seeing deception by son and wife. Okay, Yaakov deceives his father based on the order of the mother. So that's why people don't hold him responsible. They also see this as planned by God, right? That he's supposed to be the one chosen to be the next patriarch. That God had informed Rivka of this in the womb. But the wife also deceives her husband. Okay. So then we see this. So we saw this earlier with Noach's son, right? Noach has a son named Ham who deceives him, right? We don't know exactly what happened to him, but he definitely treats him that way. Then we see deception happen with Lot's daughters. They think that they're only ones left, and so they cause their father to have to pass out under the influence of alcohol, and causing the act of intercourse for reproduction, which really I interpret as rape. And there's definitely a deception going on there. Then there is deception by Reuven towards his father Yaakov. This is going, and actually there's deception by all the sons except for Binyamin towards their father. When dealing with the whole episode of Yosef, where they lie and say that essentially, or lead the father to believe that the son Yosef has been eaten by a wild animal, right? Okay. So we're going to be, there's lots of opportunity to learn from grief and loss caused by greed, hatred, and delusion, right? Which deception falls under that, right? It's usually greed of some sort, even if it's ordained by God. That lead people to behave this way so that they're lying to a blind, dying father on his deathbed. Okay. There's some things in the Torah that it can't get worse than this. It's this episode. And then later, when the brothers throw their youngest brother, Yosef, at the time, into the pit and go to sit down to have a meal, why that's happening. So we're going to see some depravity. We're going to have to see how people learn to either react or respond, either wisely or not, so that we can, on this path of this year together of learning from the Parshiyot, the weekly Torah portion, how we can learn from that to really give us strength to get through this grief and loss and trauma. Okay. The final thing I want to say, because I have to address this, the rabbinic commentary, the Parshanim, okay, which is very strong in rabbinic Judaism, thousands of years of commentary on the Torah portion, comes to interpret and also judge that there is consequences for Rivka's behavior of deceiving her husband, that she'll never see her son again, Yaakov. When she sends him off to flee as a refugee, she'll never see him again. So there's this concept in the Torah, which is very similar to the concept of karma, the law of cause and effect in the Dharma, that you behave a certain way, there are going to be consequences, meaning there are consequences for all behavior. That's the way it's seen. But sometimes, obviously, if we're doing unwise, unwholesome behavior that's causing harm and suffering, there is consequences for that behavior. We might not actually see the consequences right away, but it will be there. And so Rivka, the rabbis choose to see that her not seeing her son ever again after she gets him to flee is part of this consequence, this cause and effect. We'll also see that interpretation for Yaakov's behavior, that he deceived his blind, aging father on his deathbed, and he will be deceived over and over again. He'll be deceived by Laban, his essentially, I kind of want to call him a surrogate Abba, a surrogate father. Really, he's his uncle that he has to live under as an indentured servant, almost a slave. He's deceived by him over and over again. He's deceived by him when he goes to marry. He wants to marry his beloved Rachel. Instead, it's Leah who's there. He's deceived just over and over. Okay, so they see that as the effect from his behavior, right? The cause of that. So the other thing that they say that I have to speak out against is that they say that Yaakov's love and affection for Esau really ruin his Yaakov's power of discernment. So what does that mean? Yaakov favored his son Esau. The rabbis have a problem with this because if you know anything about rabbinic exegesis, it really interprets Esau as being the father of Edom, who is then later interpreted to be Rome. You have to realize that Rome was severely oppressive to the Jewish people, to our ancestors and the rabbis, kidnapping them, force moving them, force exile into refugee status into European countries. And the rabbis do not look kindly in reactivity to this trauma and grief and loss. And so therefore they don't interpret Esau well at all, even though today we might read this text and its Peshat and its plain form and be able to see positive, pleasant, even neutral things about Esau, in addition to finding things problematic about Yaakov, which often is not there. It is there some. So they go on to feel that his Yaakov's affection and love for Yaakov really ruin his power of discernment, that he's not able to see Esau for what he is. I want to question this deeply because I think that perhaps his affection for Esau allowed him to see him exactly as he needed to be seen, to love and appreciate him, to not vilify him or find something wrong with him or only see what's problematic or negative. They think it's only that his affection is about the food that Esau brings to him, that he goes and hunts and brings back great game for his father. But I think there's something more there, right? I think Yaakov, Esau, no, excuse me, Yitzhak has a real sensitivity based on his own trauma and grief and loss towards those who are less favored, who may not be the ones that are as desirable in the family, right? Maybe even feeling that himself was rejected, not as favorable, right? That his father ends up not slaughtering him, that his mother has passed away when he goes down to find her. So he is able to have this relationship with the child that in some ways gives him energy in life, right? And I just don't think his affection ruins his power of discernment. I think we need to reinterpret this essentially. And I think his behavior might be teaching us something, right? When we can when we can still love and appreciate someone who obviously isn't perfect, right? We all are. The final thing I will say is maybe we should start actually applying this, saying maybe it was Rivka's affection towards Yaakov that ruined her power of discernment, right? And perhaps it was her ill will towards Esav that ruined her power of discernment. And perhaps it was her greed that it be Yitzhak, that be the next patriarch, that ruined her power of discernment so that she would behave in an unethical way, that she would deceive her dying husband. These are all possibilities that often don't get faced or discussed, but what we can learn from it is, where are we deceiving either family members or ourselves? Is it out of ill will? Is it out of greed, right? Is it out of too much love, affection? It's important to always try to see clearly, right? That's the first step in the practice of mindfulness and the Dharma is, can we see things clearly? Not how we want them to be, but how things are before us. So with that, and the pain that all of us are carrying, so much so, day to day, praying for the return of the captives, engaged in a war yet again, unwanted. We attempt to see clearly what's before us, and respond as wisely as we can, as appropriately as we can, understanding there's consequences for all behavior, knowing that we are causing harm because we have to. And that's hard for anyone who wants to be on a path of not causing harm and suffering to live with. So this is why we take refuge together, support one another, because we know that we have to rid Gaza of Hamas and of the culture of terror. There has to be a de-terrorization, like a denazification, that had to happen also in Germany and Europe. And with that comes blood on our hands, consequences, right? So with that, we support one another one day at a time through this, through recovery if possible, through coping, through healing. I invite you to assume the posture that is best for you. The posture that is best for you to be present, to be simultaneously alert and at ease, which seems like a paradox, right? So I'm going to be in a seated position. You can also stand. You can walk back and forth, not walking anywhere in particular. And you can lie down with your eyes open to remain awake and alert. I come to the edge of my seat, heavy on my sit bones, spine erect. Not West Point stiff, as our teacher Jon Kabat-Zinn teaches. And I invite you to raise your shoulders with the inhalation and exhale. Oh, letting them fall all the way. If you don't feel safe with your eyes closed, then just keep them open, really grounding your feet, held by Mother Earth. If it ever becomes too much for you, open your eyes and look throughout your room and your space. Look at me on the screen to know that you are safe and that you are here. Inhalation again. And exhale. And again, inhalation. And exhale. Really inviting your full self here. Your full body, soul, coming to a sense of stillness. Inviting ease as much as you can. Even and say to yourself, I invite myself to fully be here, to be present, to be with my breath. No need to control the breath anymore, just inhalation, exhalation, allowing it to fall to its own natural rhythm. Really feeling the embodied sense of suffering. The embodied sense right now that you're anticipating the return of some of the hostages. It may feel too much to bear to really feel that. Where is it located in the body? How does it feel? Seeing if you can be with this, even kindly saying to yourself, can I be with this? Can I be with this grief and loss for a minute, this anticipation, this suffering? Acknowledging right now that we are going to attempt to bear part of this pain together in our practice by mobilizing a real warm heart-centeredness of compassion, of rachamim together. That I extend my compassion to you and you extend it to me. Really knowing that we can attempt to stay centered, that you are still here with me right now, breathing and grounded. From time to time, I will go silent to allow you to be with the practice. It is normal for the thoughts to wander. And when that happens and they go off storytelling, ruminating about the past, or planning for the future, when you become awake to that, which will happen sooner or later, simply bring yourself back to the present moment, back to my voice. As our teacher, Joseph Goldstein, teaches very clearly, these simple words, which are simply begin again. Simply begin again, bringing yourself to this present moment, to your breath and to my voice. Knowing that we can attempt to be together with quiet, tender eyes and an open heart. And know that we may need to pendulate, as Peter Levine shares on teaching about trauma. We may need to swing in to this meditation, be present. And swing out, swing back away. And you can trust that over time and taking refuge together in this practice, that we will become more able to just swing in and stay. But maybe not today. And that's okay. These are a number of things that we can resource ourselves to be able to mobilize our hearts of compassion for each other, for ourselves. Tune in to your internal sensation right now to support your sense of intactness and basic all rightness. Can you understand and feel and see that you are all right in this moment? Can we be being? Just to be with the grounding, to be with the support of nature and Mother Earth holding us heavy in the sit bones in our chair. We can do these things. And bringing again and again that tender, sweet, kind supportiveness to ourselves. Even if we have internal resistance or resistance of others, knowing that sometimes there's so much cultural or socialization that is pushing against us. But here, right now, we can be sweet and tender towards ourselves. And the more horrible it is, like our genocide of October 7th, the sweeter we need to be to ourselves, tender, persistence, and warmth and loving kindness. You may want to put your hands on your chest, even rub it, offering a moment of tenderness. Very important factor in loss and grief. So many of us will want to just click right past it, right past the trauma, right past the grief and the loss. Some of you may even be thinking, be nice, okay, whatever. But it's so fundamental to our daily coping, our daily healing. And even as these storms, these little earthquakes daily happen, we have grieving. Inside of us is a place, a core, a knowing, a witnessing that even 1/10, maybe even 1% of us is not invaded. Is not swept away, is intact, is all right. Be with the all rightness right now. Turn towards that part of you. Tracking the simple, direct evidence of your body, of how embodied this all rightness is. Is in your breath, feeling the inhalation, feeling the exhalation. We are right in this present moment, resting in the deep refuge inside of ourselves, in each other. Returning to this, building up a sense of it, knowing it. Being here with the direct experience of this right here and right now. And you may be shocked away from this awareness, whether it be a few seconds, hours, days, depending on how horrible the storm is. But coming back to that intact, indestructible, trustworthy, reliable core that we can bear witness, that we can be with, and to figure out what to do about what's happening. This is fundamental to our practice, to our healing, to our coping, to our recovery. And then, when you are ready, which does not have to be now, you go at your own pace. Part of the deep foundational practice of self-compassion is that mindfulness of where we are, being so kind to ourselves, and then tapping into the shared humanity, feeling that our suffering is part of a larger world of suffering. And obviously, there's more to the world than just suffering, but we are part of the natural process. Because we care, we grieve. We can't have caring without loss. Everything is impermanent. And when you can feel part of a larger whole, starting with your own people, Am Yisrael, starting with your fellow citizens, moving out to all the Jewish people all over the world and all of our allies, knowing that you are in a web of life, that all of us suffer, grieve, love, and lose. We are part of a larger dynamic of life. This will be part of our ongoing coping, is to tap into this shared humanity when we are ready. Really important comfort and support as we go through this grieving process. We will spend the next 5 minutes in silence. I will ring the bells when it's time to come out of the meditation. Allow yourself to tap deeper into your ease, inviting more presence and relaxation and stillness. No need to try to cause anything. Just being with whatever is here. We move into silence. Taking this last minute of our meditation to see if there's something from this time together, this practice of our mindfulness meditation that you want to remember as a resource. Noticing for yourself what has shifted from when you began this meditation to now, of recognizing and allowing what is present. Investigating it with love and kindness and compassion and curiosity and nurturing each other and ourselves. Your eyes are shut during this meditation. I invite you to gently and slowly open them. Join us back in this sacred circle on this Zoom screen or podcast audio or meeting on YouTube. Please subscribe. Joining on our blog, if you're joining in on the Zoom screen there, wherever you may be joining us from all over the world. Thank you for you and your practice. Thank you for being on this path in grief and loss and recovery, if that is the path, or if it's coping, if there's healing. May we take refuge in community together here at the Institute for Holiness, Kehillat Musar Mindfulness. May we take refuge in God. May we take refuge in our teachers and our ancestors to learn from all. May we take refuge in the path of Musar mindfulness, the great path of wisdom and toward holiness. I'm Rabbi Chassia Uriel Steinbauer, the founder and director of the Institute for Holiness, Kehillat Musar Mindfulness. Please do subscribe to our community to receive newsletters and updates. Consider joining us, especially if you want to begin practicing and learning this path in sacred community. And as I said earlier, subscribe to our YouTube channel to receive updates and videos. And God willing, I will be able to join you. I won't be able to join you this Motzei Shabbat because we will be in community. A lovely play with the Bnei Akiva community. It's a big Shabbat Irgun that happens here in Israel among the Bnei Akiva community. So, God willing, I will be able to maybe Sunday, more likely Monday. I will jump in into our next Torah portion after a. After Toledot, which is Vayetse. Okay, so please go ahead this week and read Vayetse if you're able to join in any community to listen to the Torah portion read or even volunteer to read either in synagogue or minyanim or even online. There are so many synagogues online now that offer Torah reading. Study yourself in whatever language you need to read the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, and do read some of the rabbinic commentary to gain some insight into how they are going to view some of the the narrative of our master narrative of our stories. So that's it. I'm so grateful for all of you and your support. Be in touch if you want to sponsor a session, either in honor of someone or in memory. You can reach out to me at RabbiChassia@kehilatmusar.com. And we're always welcome your donations to continue to support this work. Thank you again, and God bless. Take care.